Okay, for those people who are sitting on this side of the room, they had seen the real me, who is very scattered and passionate and clumsy and low techno skills. So you guys, I'm going to come across as if I know everything. So my name is Opal Hardgrove, and I work actually with Mission to the World, based in Atlanta. And I have been with them for 24 years. I've worn a lot of hats. I actually started as an administrative assistant, and that job lasted about 2 weeks. And they realized, you just got a taste of what I can really do to wreak havoc. And so they immediately started moving me around. Did you find it?
It's coming.
Okay. Sorry, I lost my Bible. That's the other thing. sorry about that. But the first thing I really started doing is working with Native Americans in the U.S., which is where I think God really broke my heart to just the oppressed and people that are really smushed down by society and the hopelessness that they felt. And I worked there for about 10 years, and then I overlapped working with street children in Peru, which I felt like God was taking me about as low as you could get with the way we treat each other when I began working with street children and learning their lives and their stories and spending time with them. And my official title is Director of New Projects. I think that's because they don't quite know what to do with me, so they figure if I'm doing something special, then they can always stick me somewhere. So, but what I do a lot of is development in looking for new ministries, new opportunities in different countries. And so they sent me over to Greece, Athens, Greece, because we had some Greek pastors there who wanted to see how MTW could come along beside them and help them increase their church plants and, you know, just help them out. So they sent me over, and I met with a Greek pastor. If any of you were at our main conference, Yodis Kantartsis was the guy that I met with, and he and I just immediately bonded because we were both the same. We loved the poor. We loved the marginalized. And so we would ride the streets of Athens just yakking about all the things we could do. And so he asked me, he said, what are some things you've done in the past? And so I talked about the Native American work, the street child work. And I worked for a while in Africa with women that were abused and in difficult situations, and said, he said, I've got a ministry I want you to look at. So he took me to this office, and the people there were called, and the organization was Nazoi. And he said, you're going to spend the day with them. So they took me out in probably the worst part of Athens, Greece, you could imagine. And we just started walking down the streets. And I would say all these little white lights, and they'd say, okay, we're going to go in here. And we walked in, and what it was a brothel. And it was just set up in a normal neighborhood with kids playing outside. But there were probably 10 to 15 brothels on this one street. And so we stood there on the street, and we prayed for a while. And I stood there and watched, and it was just like somebody was at Starbucks buying coffee. And these men were just coming in and out. And the kids were sitting in the windows looking at these men going in and out. And I would see men go in with their young sons, which in Greece was a rite of passage. When they reach a certain age, they take them to the brothels to have their first initiation into sex. And so then I walked into the brothel, and out walked this young lady. I know she couldn't have been more than 17 years old. As she walked out, there were six men sitting on a bench waiting for her services, and she walked over to the kitchen to say hello to us. And I looked in her face, and I had seen the movie Taken, and so I knew things like this existed. But when you meet it face to face, it's just something terribly ugly about it. And I walked out of there like totally shaken. And so we visited a few more. And I saw a trend that most of the women in there were Eastern European, Romania, Bulgaria, Moldovans. None of them were Greek. The madams were often Greek. They had madams in each house we went in. And so then they told me, we'll go out tonight. And so we went out on the street about 1 o'clock in the morning. And who we met there were all African women. And so there was a pattern there that the Eastern Europeans are in the brothels. The African women are on the streets. And just to hear the stories of how they got there would, I mean, it just broke my heart. So I came back to the U.S., and, you know, I just started praying, God, you know, this is terrible. And but surely it's not like that here. And so I started researching and reading and researching and reading and asking questions. And so finally I was introduced to this organization in Atlanta called Out of Darkness. It was just beginning. And so I went into their first training, into the first work that they were doing, and got on the ground floor with them and began, and I'll talk more about them a little bit later. I just wanted to give you my journey and how that journey led me to where I am today. I still volunteer with this organization in the U.S., but most of what I do with MTW in the arena of human trafficking is a lot of connection, a lot of going to churches and kind of raising awareness, especially in our PCA churches, about the issue and what they can do. But then I also connect, I help our teams in other countries, and I'll talk about them a little bit later too, with what they're doing and connecting them with services and organizations that might can help them where they are in their fight against this issue. So that's my story. That's how I began. So if y'all will, let me pause and pray now, because this is a tough subject for me. Jesus, we just come before your throne and just ask that you would steal our hearts. And God, make them so tender and soft to what you would have us hear. And I pray, God, that you would take all that's in my brain and just take it out. And that the words that flow would be directly from your Holy Spirit. And I pray, dear God, that the Holy Spirit would move in this room, that the awareness would be raised, your heart would be seen, and that you would call us to action. God, we love you, and we thank you that you have a heart for these dear women and children. I ask this in Christ's name. Amen. I really wanted to start off with looking at three women in the Bible. Of course, I have the wrong notes, but that's okay. The first woman that we're going to be looking at is Mary Magdalene. Rahab. We all know about Rahab. We all know her story. And we all know that she was a prostitute, that she saved the spies, and that her faith was prominent, and she had heard about God, she knew about God, but nobody had really told her about God. And so in her encounter with the spies, she was introduced to the God of Israel. And I want to not look at what Rahab was, but how God brought her into the family of Israel. They saved and spared her family because of her faith and her deed. But she wasn't only saved and just, okay, thank you so much, see you around, kid. But they brought her into their family, and she was brought into their family by her marriage to, I want to say Salom, that's not right, Salmon? Was it Salmon, I think? Yeah, because I can't say it right because I'm from the South. It's but from Salmon, and she married Salmon, and so who came from the loins of Rahab and Salmon, but Boaz. And Boaz was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David. And you keep going down the line, and you see that from Rahab's faith came Christ. What would have happened if the Israelites had not brought her into the family? We know God had a plan, so it wouldn't have been throttled. But I just am so touched with the very fact that God chose a prostitute, a woman of ill repute, to be a part of the lineage of his son, who came in total righteousness. And so that, and if you look, Rahab is only the second of, one of the two women that are mentioned in Hebrews because of her faith, and she's also mentioned in James because of her faith. So her renown spread all the way through to the New Testament, to the New Church. So she was very well known. Second woman I want us to look at was the woman at the well. And she too was a prostitute. She came The culture at that time for women was they all came to the well early in the morning to gather their water, and they all came in groups because that's when they gossiped and kind of complained about their husbands and their children. And so they all came together and they gathered around the well to get their water and have their community time. But if you read in Scripture, this woman came later in the day, and she came alone. Why did she come alone? She was rejected. She was a woman of ill repute and could not relate to the other women that were there. She was rejected. She was an outcast. But who so tenderly began to probe into her life and get all the way down to the nitty-gritty of, you're not even married to the man you're with now, you know, and pushed on her until he was able to present himself to her and tell her who he was. And what did she do? She became an evangelist. She ran back to the very city that had rejected her and had pushed her away to tell them that Christ, the Messiah, was here, and come in here because he knows all about me, but he still talked to me. You know, she didn't say that. I would have said it. He still talked to me, and he still presented himself to me. And so she brought the whole village out to see and meet the Messiah. Remember, the disciples had already been in the city, and all they were concerned about was getting food to eat. They hadn't thought about the need for these people in that village to hear the gospel. But this woman who had been rejected by that city had a heart for those people, and she brought them back out. Again, look at what she became after Christ touched her. Not what she was before, but what happened after. And then there was always dear, sweet Mary Magdalene, who was herself a prostitute. And I have heard and read, and I don't know how true this is, that really what she washed Jesus' feet with was the prostitutes in those days wore a pendant that was filled with a particular type of perfume that let off an aroma that let people know that she was a prostitute. It was an aroma that as they walked by, they knew. But it was also her livelihood. It was her life. That's how she made her living. But she took that very expensive oil to her and poured it on the feet of Jesus and wept at his feet. And who ridiculed her? The leaders of the church. They, as Isaiah said, were pointing their fingers at her. And what do you mean? She's not worthy to even be in my house. You know, do you know what this woman is? And Jesus knew. And she is known for her faith as well. Look at all the scripture. And what she was one of the women who was able to go to the disciples and say, the Lord has arisen. She had a very integral part in Jesus' ministry and who Jesus was. And again, look at who she was before. But once Jesus touched her life, look at who she became and what she became. So my goal for you today, as we go through this, is to kind of think about these women and the issue, not at what they are and who they are, but look at what they can be if the Church of Christ would rise up and reach these women and bring them into the fold and minister them in the way that Christ ministered to the women that came into his life. So that's my goal. What I want to do through this whole process is kind of help you in begin. I am no expert at all. And there are probably people in here that know far more than I do. And so please speak up if I miss cue or if I leave something out. It's something that God has put on my heart. And to this day, I see the image of those women and those problems when I shut my eyes at night. It's just very important to me that the church sees the need to reach these women and children. So let's talk a little bit about what trafficking is. And I'm going to give you a definition. It is the exploitation of, it is a recruitment for the purpose of transporting a person for labor or service through fraud, force, coercion, for the purpose of involuntary servitude, debt, bondage, or slavery. That's trafficking as a whole, which is going on in our world, unbelievable. Not just in the sex trade, but of human lives. Actually, there are more slaves today than the history of the United States, or the history of that we've ever had slavery. There are more today than there ever have been. And so then what is sex trafficking? It's the same thing, the exact same thing, except the sole purpose for the coercion, the trading, the moving, the selling of the person is specifically for sex acts. And so what does it look like today? I swear I picked up the wrong nose. I'm so sorry, people. There are 2 million children that are involved in the act of sex trafficking today throughout the world. That's not in the United States, but just throughout the world. There are 800,000 people that are transported across lines every day for the purpose of trafficking and for sales, sex trafficking. The average cost, the income from that industry is $32 billion a year. These statistics are actually from like 2007, so it's probably even more than that today because the numbers have increased. It's a lot larger. The average age of a person that hits the street is usually around 12 to 14 years of age. They say the average lifespan is 7 years, and that's usually because of, you know, violence, disease, and just other issues, drug abuse, alcohol abuse. Those are kind of what's happening. So what does it look like? It includes street prostitution, pornography, strip clubs, escort services, nude massage parlors. I don't think I've got nail salons on here, but you need to check your nail salons out because it's proactive in those places. Private parties, gang-based prostitution, families selling their children. That's not happening. That's happening to us today in our country, especially on our Native American reservations. Families are selling their children. I just got an article the other day. Families, mainly in Canada, tribes selling their children into this. Internet-based exploitation. What makes people fall into this? What makes them vulnerable? Here are some things. I would say, out of most of the women that we've worked with in Atlanta, I would say probably 100% of them were abused as children. And the view is, I know I had one lady say, "Well, you know, somebody took it from me for free. If somebody wants to pay me, then I'm all for that." So, lack of parental oversight, latchkey kids, single parent homes, kids that left alone a lot. Sometimes kids are out looking for a new adventure and a new start, low self-esteem, debt bondage. It's a cultural norm in some places. And then runaways. And this is, I don't have my right notes, but there's a statistic that I think there's something like 100,000 to 150,000 runaways in the U.S. a year. And about, I think it's like 60% of those are turned into traffic. They become trafficked within 48 hours of hitting the streets. How do these people, these pimps, get them? Here are some of the places. Can anybody see this? Would it help if we turn the lights off, you think? Their social circles, you know, people they hang with, their home neighborhoods. I mean, we think, and this is not, we tend to think in more of your poverty-stricken neighborhoods. It's happening in our suburbia neighborhoods big time. Clubs, bars, maybe they go to visit other neighborhoods and they're picked up there from the internet. Internet sales are rapidly rising. Just out and about on the stroll, kids out walking. They can be kidnapped. They can be coerced. In school, you wouldn't believe how many people's friends have convinced them to to go into the trafficking business to make extra money to buy nice clothes. In the mall, this is a huge place. I had a friend tell me that her daughter was in one of the malls that's not too far from my house, and she is an attractive girl, and this man approached her with his card and said, "Wow, you're so pretty. Your makeup looks so nice. I have a business, a modeling business, and here's my card. If you'll call me, you know, I'll be glad to, you know, help you get, you know, establish your career." Believe me, he wasn't about modeling. Not the good kind of modeling. And then in transit stations, I know in Atlanta, I'm going to talk a lot about Atlanta because I know a lot more about Atlanta than anywhere else, but we have MARTA in Atlanta. And so what the people from the poor neighborhoods, we have a section called Lenox Square. And so the people from the poor neighborhoods will take the MARTA station up to Lenox to get out to see, just kind of see Lenox, you know, and Square and look at the mall and the fancy clothes. Well, right outside is the MARTA station. It is normally surrounded with pimps waiting for these girls to come up, and they immediately jump them. And these guys have the keenest sense of knowing a girl or a young boy that is vulnerable. Maybe they're kind of the one on the outside, or maybe they're a little bit overweight and they don't quite fit in. Those are the ones they go after. Because they can, they are masters of manipulation. Masters. If they were psychologists, we may not have any mental illness if they used it in the proper way, because I've never heard stories like I've heard the way they manipulate these young girls and young boys into the life. And they're in it before they realize it. There's a new phenomenon that has started, and it's, I don't know, you may have heard about this, but it's called sugar daddies. Has anybody heard of that? It is a web-based program where men advertise for co-ed young girls in college that might need help with their tuition or their books or their apartment. And so they sign them on as a escort or a friend, and they'll pay their tuition for them. And so I think there's, the last statistic I saw, there's something like 700,000 girls that have been approached with this. And so they, you know, it sounds like a good deal. All they want to do is maybe take them to parties and stuff, but they don't realize that the trap they're getting into, they're being led into issues. And the organization I work with in Atlanta rescued a girl a couple of years ago from the University of Georgia who had got caught up in it, and it wound up, it wasn't just one man she was being escorted for, but it was several. So, and she finally escaped, and we got rehab for her and helped her out of that situation. Here are your top 10 schools. Look at those. I don't know where you're from. I have a list of 20, but to shorten my talk, I took the 20 off. But Georgia State was boasting last year because they were number one on this list. They thought it was something to brag about. So, yeah. So that's a new thing that's happening on college campuses now. And now I want to take a moment to connect this to pornography. And I have been told I'm not supposed to talk about pornography in churches, so I'm not, you know. I really want us to stop and think about the issue of pornography, because most people look at it and say that it's a victimless crime, nobody's being hurt. But let me tell you that most of the, if your view, and I'm not saying you, if you're viewing free pornography, then the person that's doing whatever is being done on that is doing it, it's being done by force. They are not voluntarily doing whatever is happening at what you're viewing. There's probably somebody off camera holding the gun and making them do and perform the acts that they're performing. So just realize that it is a direct tie to the issue of human sex trafficking for our children. And I've heard, and from things that I've read, the age of people getting caught in trafficking is actually getting younger and younger and younger, because men are concerned about the issue of HIV/AIDS. So they're starting to see younger and younger victims to protect themselves. So it is, it's growing, and it is unbelievable. And pornography is making the demand huge. How many of you here know who Ted Bundy is? How many of you remember the story of Ted Bundy? Did you see the interview that he had, or read the interview, or hear the interview that he had with James Dobson right before he died? And the reason he did that is because he wanted America. Now, this is 1980. Was it 80? I think. He wanted America to know the damage that pornography was doing to our young people in 1980. And the reason he wanted to talk to James Dobson is because he said, I started my pilgrimage in this issue when I found a girly magazine in a garbage can. And I picked it out and I looked at it. And, you know, the more I grew, the more I looked at, the least satisfied, the less satisfied I was. So I had to do more and do more and do more. And then it turned into rape. And then he accidentally killed one of the girls. And then that was a bigger rush. And so if you don't know who he was, he started in Washington State and came all the way across and wound up in Florida where he was finally caught. And I think they accused him of like 10, but they're estimating they're probably more like 40 to 50 women that he had killed across the country. That started from pornography. And ladies and gentlemen, what he saw back then is what we're looking at in commercials on our TV today. So you cannot imagine the pornography that's on our websites now that our young people are getting to with no problem. I work at MTW. I work a lot with college students. And just about, I would say probably 95% of the one, not just the guys, the girls too, have an issue with pornography. And the pornography that we're seeing now is becoming more and more brutal. So it's, sin does not stand still. Just a few little things to let you know that every year there are 13,000 new porn movies made. It is a $93 billion a year industry. And this is all done at the expense of our women and children that are, for the most part, not there because they want to be, but because they have been coerced and pulled into it. Okay, so what can we do? All right? Number one, let's look at the Bible again. Look at what God said. Read the stories. We won't go through all of these due to time, but just read through. Remember, Genesis 1 tells us we were made in the image of God. All of us were. These women and children that are being exploited were made in the image of God. If you read the story of Joseph, if you look at the definition of trafficking, he had been trafficked. He was trafficked by his family and wound up in prison because someone was trying to sexually exploit him. So he's a good story to read and look at. Look at Hosea. What was his life? God told him to go and marry the prostitute. How many times? Show the forgiveness, you know? Look at the commands that God gives to his people. And if you look, they're all action verbs. Just to look at follow justice, speak up, seek justice, rescue, defend, loose, break yokes, spend yourselves. In other words, I heard a guy from International Justice Mission speak. He said, are you willing to get dirty? Are you willing to get dirty for God? Because you get dirty in this business. So, it is my full belief that God is not just calling his people to be informed and to be sad and to be upset about it, but I think he's calling us to action. I think he wants us to do something. So, what can we do? Well, we can definitely learn about the issue. I've touched on a couple of little things. But if you learn about what is going on globally, I'm just going to share some stories from MTW with what we're doing in a global perspective. We have a team that is working in Bulgaria, Sofia, Bulgaria. And they've been there for many, many years, but they just suddenly started noticing these women that stood on what they call the ring road that goes around the city of Sofia. And they would always be standing out at night, no matter what the temperature, no matter what the weather, and they would notice cars stopping. And, you know, and getting the women in the car. So they began going out and visiting these women. And so they go out every Sunday night, and in the winter they carry them hot chocolate and coffee, and in the summer they bring them a cool drink. And they just love them. And so they are known now, when they drive up, the women all yell, here's the people that love us. They're bringing the hands and feet of Christ to these women who otherwise are abused, they're not cared for, they're beaten. If I had the time, I'd go through the life of a woman. It is unbelievable what happens to these women. Unbelievable. That's our team in Bulgaria. They're working in, actually what they're looking at now is they've connected with an organization in Canada. There's nowhere, if these women want to be rescued in Sofia, there's nowhere for them to go. There's nowhere in Bulgaria for these women to go and be safe. So there's an organization in Canada that develops programs for women who are rescued from the street. And it's a long-term rehab program. They believe that it takes 3 to 7 years in one woman's life to help her get over the issues that she's been through. That's medical care. That's, you know, psychological care. That's ministry. That's feeding them Jesus' love every single day. And but the longest, and they say the majority of them have to go for 7 years just to learn to trust and learn to live life. Most of these women work at night and sleep in the day. So we have them come in that don't even know how to cook. They have no clue how to, just normal life skills, because they've lived life at night and with a quota they have to bring in before they can come home. So our team in Bulgaria is working with this place in Canada, and hopefully they're going to develop a home there. Then we have a team in Cambodia. We have one girl, and that's her total focus, is to work in Cambodia with ministries that are already out there. Cambodia is much more a child-oriented country, so most of them are children, are pretty much sold by their families, and put in karaoke bars. And so her goal is working with ministries that rescue these girls, and they are helping them, give them skills, opening businesses. She's actually overseeing a bed and breakfast they've opened now for Christian groups when they come in, and the girls are learning how to do appropriate care, you know, cooking and things like that. Really neat. I've got a really neat story. It's not neat. It's heart-wrenching. But this is what it looks like in Cambodia. She had gone to her language school one day, and she had a driver that normally picks her up in their little, I forget what they call them, the little motor car things. You know, it's like a motorcycle with a hood over it. And so he had come to pick her up, and as they were getting in, and they were came up to a red light, she looked over and she saw this little girl, and she was in her blue pajamas, and her daddy was holding her hand. And he had been talking on the phone, and he turned the phone off, and he put it in his pocket, and in a little bit, she saw this man pull up on a little scooter, and the daddy went to put the little girl on the back of the scooter, and she was clinging to him so tightly, and the man that was driving the scooter gave him some money, and the dad, forced the little girl onto the scooter and said, "You'll be home in about 3 hours. Have a good time." And that little, and Carrie was sitting on that little thing, and she couldn't think, she didn't have the right words, and she said, all I could do was scream out, "Stop, stop." And she said, about that time, the red light turned green, and her driver took off, and she said, the last thing I see is that little girl looking right into my eyes with fear beyond. So that's what she's facing on the field. It's a child-oriented business there. It is what is called a destination country, which means people go there for sex, and mainly with children. Same as in Thailand. I was in Thailand. I visited Cambodia and Thailand together just to kind of see what was happening. And Thailand is like something I've never seen before in my life. They took me down to the karaoke district, and it was like walking in one of our huge malls in the U.S., but it was all karaoke bars, and it was all full of young girls. And I remember the lady that was with me, she's the director of our Mercy department, and she looked at me and she said, "It looks like bugs, because every time I turn around, somebody's coming out. These girls are just coming from nowhere." And I can't even imagine how many girls were in there. And there were just as many men walking the streets. And, you know, I walked through there just in total shock, and I was with a Thai woman. And we started out, and these two big buses pulled up, and she walked up to me, and she said, "Now, this is your Japanese tours." And it was two buses full of Japanese men that got off and headed off down into the karaoke bars. And she said, "And this is not even tourist season. So the biggest of the business wasn't coming in yet." And so I looked at her, and I said, "You know, I'd give anything more if I had an Uzi I said, you know, I think I'd just go, you know, and she said, but think of the men. She said, the women are using the men. The men are using the women. She said, Opal, the men need Jesus too. And I thought, you know, she's right. You know, we're all sinners, and I can't point my finger. And I need to pray for them as much as I need to pray for those girls. And so, and I was just recently in Nepal, where I visited a couple of different ministries that work in the issue of trafficking there in Nepal. And I visited one that does a border ministry along the borders of India and Nepal. And their goal is to stop the girls being moved out. It seems like the Nepal women are taken into India, moved through India, on into the Middle East for sale. And so their job, they get there on the border, and they have some border police that work with them, and they rescue as many as they can coming across the border. So that is Nepal. That's Asia. Asia is probably your biggest destination country. Europe is more a supply country where most of the time they're sent out to other places. They're tracing. Moldova used to be the largest exporter of women. Tiniest little country in Eastern Europe, but it's the biggest exporter because of the orphanages. And but I think Bulgarian women are showing up all over the place now. So it's, sin just grows, ladies and gentlemen. It just grows. Learn about it locally. Let's look back now at the United States. Drugs is the number one criminal business in America. Arms used to be number two. It has been surpassed by human beings. And we're going to see just a little bit more that it's pushing on up above drugs now. And it is just growing astronomically. This is a study that was done in 2007. I think this one was done by the Urban... it's the Urban Ministry. Anyway, you can see all the pink places are your biggest pockets of where you find the issue of trafficking or human sales, underground mostly. So you see Atlanta has got a great big circle. Talk a little bit more. It has the largest underground commercial sex economy in the United States. It makes $290 million in 2007. Denver is the smallest. There's another study I'm going to show you in just a little bit. Some of the industries in the five cities had dropped, but Seattle and Atlanta grew. And then we're going to see on another graph, Miami also grew. But Seattle's market grew from 123% to $61.7 million over the last 4 years. So it is big business. And can I tell you, they are very protective. This is the average income of a pimp per week. In Atlanta, $32,833 a week. All the way down to the lowest is Kansas City at $5,000. No taxes paid on that money either. It's all free. And it comes at the risk of a lot of women and children. Here is the size of the underground economy. Now, it's taking guns, which are blue, drugs are red, and if you can see the yellow or lime green or whatever it's supposed to be, you can see how it has spiked up in Atlanta. So it is way left behind, drugs and guns. And the same is true in Miami. You see it's growing. It's going up. This is a more recent one. I think this one was done like 2011, I think. So it's a more recent study. That just goes to prove the point that it's not stopping. How does this take place? Here is our U.S. truck routes. This is the way all of our truckers go across the U.S. Take a good look at that. This is your trafficking route. Mm-hmm. If I could lay them on top of each other, they'd match. A lot happens on truck stops. I don't know how many of you stop at them, but a lot happens on truck stops. A lot of change takes place in those places. Now, I want us to get really real. This is happening next door. I want to put a face to this. This just happened in March in Atlanta. This man is a principal of a school. I think he was in Douglasville. He had been a school administrator for 18 years, and he was a school principal at this particular time that he was caught and arrested for soliciting sex with a minor. That's our school system. These were other people that were caught, and the reason I've got it up here is I want you to look at the life. It's no particular group of people. You go from a musician all the way down to, I guess, a truck driver. They're a salesman, an engineer. Two of these people were women, and two of those people came from the little bitty town I live in. I live in Winder, Georgia, which is a population of about 8,000. But two of those had traveled to solicit sex with a minor, and they were caught. Praise the Lord.
Who did the operation work with her? Law enforcement?
GBI and FBI, I think, together. All right, so learn about the issues in your community. What's going on in your little town? I think you'd be surprised if you spent some time talking to your law enforcement, talking to some of your local ministries, your NGOs, figure out what's happening, and then what is your state doing about it? What is your state? What are the laws in your state, in your town, in your city? Get familiar with those and get to know what's happening in your own state, in your own town. Think about your churches. Does this happen in our church? I have a very, very close friend who had a very, very close friend who is actually, this guy was from Florida. And when her husband was a pastor in Florida, he was his best friend. He was a ruling elder in the church, very well respected in the community, president of the Board of Education, a lawyer, a CPA, had won Citizen of the Year many, many times, six children, two grandchildren. He just got 5 years for soliciting sex with a minor on the internet. So it's happening in our churches. So when we think about bringing the Rahabs, no, this is not what I want that way. When you think about bringing the Rahabs and the woman at the well and Mary Magdalene in your church, are they going to feel safe in your church? Another story, a big church in Atlanta has a phenomenal ministry to girls that work in strip bars. And they had finally got three of them, some of them to come to church with them. But the girls couldn't go through the door because they looked in and there sat their customers. And so they couldn't go in. So stop and ask yourself, is our church safe? And we'll talk about what you can do. Now, if you want to get in this, if God is kind of stirring your heart a little bit, and you think, wow, this may be something our church can do, or maybe our church wants to at least begin to make this, make our congregation aware of the issue, to protect your children, to educate your children. Then begin to look at the people in your church, look at the gifts, the occupations, things that you have there. What are your talents? What are your gifts? And then look at your missions, your leadership, missions committees. Where are they invested? Where are they heading? Where are they taking you as a church? And then begin to know that the church is called to be the light. Remember? Don't put that bushel over, but be a light that sits on the hill so that others can see. So that the Rahabs and the Mary Magdalenes and the women of the well feel comfortable as they walk into your building. And the first thing I tell you to do is to pray. Prayer should be our first response, not our last resort. And if you have an inkling that you want to enter into this, then you better bathe yourself in prayer. When I first started working, the organization told me you need to find 10 people that are going to be willing to pray for you because you're walking into the devil's den and he does not want you there. And I have had nightmares and dreams and things that I would never imagine since I started working in this business. Since I have started becoming more proactive against the business, let's say. So pray. And again, pray some more. Spend some time in groups praying. I don't know if you have community groups in your church or your Sunday school, whatever. Spend time together praying with each other about how God may be leading you. I would encourage you to take your Bible and go through Scripture and read what God says through all those action verbs and what is the context and what is he talking about, and look at what God's heart says for the poor and the orphaned and the widowed and the oppressed and those that are in bondage and held down with the wicked. There's a lot in there. It'd take a year to get through it all if you really want to sink down into it. And then organize something that's regular to pray. And I would encourage you to do prayer walks in your own city. And as you're praying, ask God to open your eyes to see what is going on here. What am I missing? It's like, I was in Cheryl's talk earlier, and she said when she goes overseas and she looks, she comes home with clearer eyes of what is happening in her own community. And I think as you start praying and asking God, open my eyes and let me see, he will. Believe me, he will. And then discover what gifts you have. Do you have someone that has a deep heart for mercy? Don't let them go in it alone. Make sure they've got someone that's administrative and can hold them back a little bit, because us mercies tend to get out of control sometimes and do things we shouldn't. And then begin to serve. Don't jump the gun and don't just run out and start doing something because you want to be a Rambo in this. Because if you do, you put yourself in danger, but really, more importantly, you put the women and the children in danger. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you can get them killed in a heartbeat. It's not easy. So just remember that and be committed to it. And again, look at your church. What is your church doing on a personal level within your own body? What is your church doing on a local level and then globally? And then began to look at, in your church, what are your unique talents and gifts? And in your community, what is that clearly defined need that you may see that is happening here? And then what is God calling your church to do? You and your church. And then began to look at, all right, so how would this fit into what our church is doing with Justice and Mercy? And is there an arm for this particular type of ministry in my church? And this is, I'm just going into, let me see where I am, yeah. I'm almost done. How am I doing? Let's start serving. And here is when I've talked to a lot of women that are in the business, and I've talked to a lot of pimps, not a lot of pimps, one or two. And there's one that I know that is a believer now. He's actually in seminary. God brought him. So you got to pray for those pimps. God brought him to himself. He's in seminary. He's left the life. And he comes to a lot of trainings now and trains those of us who want to work on what the life is. And he uses the pimp language and he shocks us, you know, like, whoa, I can't believe he said that. But if you're going to work in it, you got to know what the lingo is. You got to understand it. But he said, he grew up, I think, in the Bronx. And he said, I grew up, my grandfather was a pimp, my daddy was a pimp, my uncle was a pimp and drug dealer, so what do you think I'm going to be? And there are a lot of women that have said, you know, my mother was a hoe, my grandmother, my sisters, so what do you think I'm going to be? That's all I know. So look in your town. This is a great prayer walk thing. Look in your town and look in your neighborhoods and say, where can our church invest in these young women and these young men? Most of them are from single-parent homes. They have a lot of time on their hands. A lot of them are in foster care, which is a ripe place for traffickers to hit. And how can you as a church, I mean, that's minor, to invest in a child. To say, you know, my thing is, if we can prevent this, that's a huge step, if we can just prevent it. So where can your church invest in these young men and young ladies that really need to understand what it means to be made in the image of Christ, that Christ loves them no matter who they are, what they've done, they're important to him. And only the church can do that. Because one of the things I want us to hear is we've got a lot of organizations that are working in this business. We've got some that are not Christian. And we have some Christians, organizations that are working. But as you've seen, the numbers are growing. It's not slowing down. And the the lady that I know in Canada that develops these homes, she writes me. She's a sweet little French lady, and she is full of power. She's been doing this since 1980. She started bringing women into her home and then has developed this business. And she said, oh, well, we've got so much work to do. And she said, the church, we've got so much work to do because the devil is so active. And so pray and see if we can prevent this. Just, you know, let's bring that number that are in there down by preventing, talking in your schools, talking to your kids in the church. You know, kids are starting very young today talking about sex and exploring. I got an 8-year-old grandson that lives in Germany, and I mean, this is minor, but he asked his mother the other day what a honeymoon was. And she said, why do you want to know what a honeymoon is? And he said, because they were talking about it at school. You know, so, you know, these kids are, they see a ton on TV. And so they're educated way smarter than I was when I was growing up. Spend your money. Look at an organization. I don't know, there's a Charlottesville, Virginia. There is a woman, she started a home, she worked with a home in New York City that housed women that had been trafficked from foreign countries. It's based, connected to Redeemer. And then they have a home where women that are trafficked from out of the country, it's a safe house. And she has since moved to, I think it's Virginia, and she is opening up the same type home for foreign trafficked women to have a safe place. I think she works very closely with Homeland Security, and they give her referrals and everything. But again, think about the investment that it takes. If it takes 7 years to help a woman through this, you think of the services that woman needs. She needs, number one, she probably comes in pretty much addicted to drugs and alcohol. Her body is battered and abused. A lot of them have a lot of disease that they need to be treated for. Dental care, just psychological healing, life skills training. Like I say, most of them come in and they don't know how to cook. They don't know what it is to live a normal. They don't know how to shop because the pimp always does their shopping. They have no clue what it means to live a life in the daytime because their life is at night. And so they need life skills trainers. They need just one woman. And people say, well, is it really worth it? And every time I hear that statement, I want to scream because I want to say, was it worth it for Christ to die for me all by myself? And he would have done that if it was just me. So is it not worth us spending a little bit of money to save one person? So the cost for one life to me, I don't think you can put a cost on life. A lot of these places need help. The women need mentors. They need people to come along beside them and be friends with them and love them. And, you know, if you know how to cook, you can teach them. If you know how to sew, you can teach them to sew. Teach them life skills. You don't have to be a professional to do that. They need doctors. They need ways to get to doctors. They need people to take them to therapy. They need people to come and take them out for coffee occasionally and just love them. I know there's one lady that said, I never knew what it was like for somebody to approach me and to really love me, and I don't have to give them anything back. There's nothing you want from me. They couldn't grasp that. And it takes years for them to learn to trust again. So anything you can do like that. I wanted to share with you kind of what the organization I work with in Atlanta does. And it's called Out of Darkness. And I have a resource list. If you haven't got one, I've got enough. You should be able to get it. From this sweet little lady right here. And what we did is Out of Darkness actually started as a hotline. The guy that started is a single man. He was a lawyer. And God just laid on his heart what was happening in Atlanta. And so he would pray every day, you know, what do you want me to do? So he kind of researched and realized that these women, if they want off the street, there's nowhere they can go. There's no phone number they can call. And you'll have this on your list, too. There's a 1-800 number. That's the National Trafficking, Human Trafficking line. And then Polaris Project also has a hotline. And so if they really wanted to, they could call that hotline number, but that's in D.C. So if they're in Georgia and they need help immediately, then they got to find somebody in Georgia that's going to help them. And so he began thinking, okay, we need a hotline. So he established a hotline. He got volunteers to answer the phone. And then all of a sudden, women wanted out, and he had nowhere to put them. That's the other issue in this country. I think there are only, I better not give a statistic because I'm sure it's changed. There are very, very few beds in our country for these women. They're just not places that is safe for them to go, that where they can get all the care they need. And so there was nowhere for them to go. So he started, I think we now have 3 safe houses that we put them through until we can find somewhere that they can go. Normally it's out of state right now because the only one woman shelter we had just closed in Atlanta. So as for younger children, there's only one, and I think they only have something like 25 beds for children. And so what happens with children is they just go to the juvenile detention center, and that's where they're stuck. So those are huge needs. So anyway, we've got the safe houses, and so now he's beginning to realize, wow, we really need to start some long-term care facilities for these women. So he is connected to the person in Canada also, and he's going up to look and see if maybe there's a franchise or a partnership that we can start in Atlanta to begin developing some homes in Atlanta for these women there. So it just kind of grew like this, you know. It just like he did this, and God honored it, and he did this, and God opened the store, and it's just amazing to see how it works. But some of the things that we do within that ministry is we did a poster, and we still do a poster campaign. We go up and down the major interstates and the trucking routes, and we put up posters with our hotline number in it that in the women's bathrooms. It has our hotline number on it, and so we put them in truck stops. Some restaurants, if they'll let us, quick trips, racetracks, any kind of station like that that will let us put posters in, that we put posters in up and down the major truck routes in our city. And then they have a medical outreach team that goes into emergency rooms specifically, but we'll also go to doctor's offices and all to train them on what to look for when a woman comes in. And the signs to let them look for so that they'll know if she's been trafficked or not. And that worked because in one of our hospitals, we had a woman that was brought in. She'd been trafficked to Atlanta from Wisconsin. And the person that was taking care of her had just been through the training, the medical training, and she recognized it, and she called the Fulton County Police, and they came and rescued her. And we got her back home. So it works. And let's see, we do the poster campaign, the medical outreach. We do a prison outreach, and we visit. We have a great relationship with the Fulton County Police Department, and so they've made inroads for us to get into Fulton County Prison there. And so we have a group of women that go in and visit the women that have been caught and are in prison. And so they, you know, go in and they minister to them. They read the Bible. They do Bible studies with them. And then when they are out, they will normally call us, and then we'll help them kind of get back on their feet and, you know, get back into something other than the life they were arrested for. We do a lot of public speaking, you know, just raising awareness to the public. It's out there and people know about it, but it is amazing how little is being done. It's kind of like God is not wanting us to look at it and go, you know, we're his children. And I believe this wound is only going to be healed when the church stands up and speaks against it and rallies. And I'm not talking about being Rambos. Now, I would be a Rambo, but I've learned that there's a way to go about doing it, and there's a way that's protective for the women and the children. And I've talked a lot about women. But it is happening to our young boys, too. We don't have as many statistics on boys. That's a little bit more hidden. But it's happening, and it's growing. I know when I was in Cambodia, I met with the IJM office there and was talking about what they did. And she said, you know, it's amazing. It's just like James says, you know, sin does not stand still. She said it doesn't stand still, but the other thing is it changes. She said, because when we think we've got it figured out, and we know what we're doing, and we got them, all of a sudden it's a new tactic comes up and we have to start all over figuring out what are they doing now, you know, and it's the truth. It's just unbelievable. So anyway, one book that I think, I don't think we've got it on the resource list. I just got it. And I have to read it, and then I put it down for a little while, and then I read it some more. But this is excellent for churches. It's called In Our Backyard. And it gives you a lot of the statistics and stuff I've given you came from this book. It's good. And it's just talking about the U.S. and what's happening in small town. It gives you lots and lots of examples of how these young girls, not just sex trafficking, but just human trafficking in general, how it's happening in our own country. And so it raises your awareness and of what to look for.
Who's it by?
Nina Bells. It's an excellent book. I really recommend it. Like I say, I read it for a while and I put it down. Which I do with all of my, anything I read on trafficking, it takes me a year to read it because it's just too tough. Yes?
It was hopeful to hear you talk about somebody who's, the Lord is bringing out of the industry from this gentleman who's now in seminary. And do you hear, is he the only story that's out there? Let's just say men who've been involved in maybe on the front lines.
You know, I know him personally. I don't know a lot of them. Like I say, I don't know a lot of the pimps, but I know there is an excellent documentary. If you want to, I think it's on the list. It's called Nefarious. It's put out by Exodus Cry, and it is wonderful. And my favorite part of that story, and it will make you weep all the way through. It was made by a group out of Kansas City, I think, who they just got a real heart for it. And so they started in Eastern Europe and went from Eastern Europe to Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to Cambodia, Thailand, and back to the U.S. And he talked with pimps, he talked with traffickers, he talked with people that run the storefronts in Amsterdam, he talked to the prostitutes themselves. He talked to ministries that worked with the children in Cambodia and Thailand. But there's one on there, and he is a former trafficker. And, you know, Eastern European, big burly guy, you know, tattoos everywhere. And the Lord intervened in his life, and he was saved. And he talks about his experience, and he said, you know, the first couple of times I did that, it was really hard. And he said, but then they just all turned into money. And he said, and every time I saw a woman, it was just more money. And he said, so the things we did to her just got to the point where it didn't bother me anymore. And he said, he said, I didn't have an issue with it until, I guess, somehow when he was introduced to Christ. And he talks on about his life, and he said, you know, I'm a captive. She's a captive. We're all captive. But Jesus came to set the captive free. And to me, he just says it right there, plain and simple. They need Jesus. And I know there's one of the organizations, I think it's Nightlight International, there's a chapter in Atlanta, but there's one in Bangkok. And they are offering, opening, it's probably open now, a coffee shop right at the entrance of the karaoke bars. And so they are, and then they're manning it with men from their church. And so, you know, the guys will come in for coffee, and so they're there, right there, to confront them with what they're doing. And so maybe the Lord will use that, too. No, maybe. He will, you know. So. Yes?
So thank you for your talk. This is a topic that's, really pinches a nerve, I guess you could say. I don't really know what the Lord is doing as to why I find myself in situations where I just rub shoulders with these women. And that was, you know, from my time overseas, I thought I was going to do missions in Beirut, Lebanon, to reach out to Muslim women, and then all of a sudden I find myself being taken for a prostitute just because I'm a little, you know, and find out so many people are trafficked into that country just so they can make money. And then here in the U.S. as well, it seems like you know, just like you said, going to a nail salon or a spa, you think it's completely innocent, and then, you know, I've heard of friends who get accosted with their purchases, and, you know, people think things, that they're there for the wrong reason. But it just seems so peculiar that law enforcement doesn't seem to be so active in pursuing or prosecuting, at least from my perspective, because if we as just, I mean, we're no experts by any means, but if this is all blatantly happening before us and everybody knows in the neighborhood that that's the bar where, you know, this is a salon where you go, this is the restaurant, this is the lounge that you go to for services, why is it, if neighborhood people know that, why isn't, why in your perspective and experience isn't law enforcement doing anything?
All right, the question is, why isn't law enforcement doing anything? But they are, as best they can. It is a huge, it's a money-making industry. And for a lot of it is backed by mafia, illegal businesses, gangs. You know, this is one of the major resources of money for gangs. I can speak only for Georgia, and I know that our GBI and our FBI, because I've met with both of them and talked to them, and in our Atlanta, Fulton County, they are doing all they can do. I mean, all the arrests I told you about were done by the GBI. And I met with their CSEC, which is the Child Sexual Exploitation team in Atlanta, and talked with them, and I said, you know, what do you feel like the need is? And this one guy looked at me. He really looked like the Hulk. That was the biggest man I think ever. And his arms were like this. And I was like, I would never mess with that man. But, you know, he said, you know, if you could give me anything for Christmas, I wish you'd give me a place to take these children. He said, we arrest them. We have nowhere to place them. And there was a woman sitting there. She said, I arrested one 14-year-old girl. And she said, she sat there and watched me. She said, the whole time I was saying, I'm going to help you. I'm going to get you out of this. You're not going to have to go back into this life. And she called everything, every service she could think of. And nobody would take her. They had no room. So she said, I had to wind up taking her to a homeless shelter. And she said, who do you think followed us? And within 15 minutes, got her out of the homeless shelter and put her back in business again. But praise the Lord, they finally caught that man, and he's in prison for 32 years now. So they're doing all they can do. And it is, I asked him, my biggest thing is the massage parlors. Like, you know, going down one of our interstates, you have these big signs that say stop. And I said, can't you just go in there and do something? And he said, you know, it is so organized. He said, and we would have to put someone in so deep into that, but it wouldn't even be safe for them to be in there. And he said, what happens is they know if we're coming. And we can walk into one of those and it's cleaned out. There's nothing there. It's organized so well. Yes?
For what it's worth, I live in a little city in Pennsylvania, but it's pretty urban. And there was a bar a couple blocks away from my house that, to my knowledge, there was a lot of gun violence. And the neighborhood was complaining about it quite a bit. It took a year or so for the police to shut it down. But it took this effort between the police and neighbors who are concerned for them to build a strong enough case to shut down the business. And so I just wonder if there's something in your city where word on the street lets you know that there's something happening there. Obviously, you don't, you know, the mob's behind it or a gang's behind it. You don't want to take this on by yourself. But if you're concerned, I wonder if you could go to the police and say, what can local people who are concerned about this do to work with you?
Yeah, that's one of the things, is go to your local police and see what they're doing. So, go to the locals, your law enforcement, and ask them, what are they doing?
Like, because they can't just go into a business because of word on the street. And
exactly.
You know, anything they find, if they're in there illegally, you know, without a warrant, without enough evidence, one won't be admissible and everything. But they would probably, at least in my limited experience in my city, the police are really thrilled when there's any sort of community organization who wants to work with them to give them information so that over time they can build enough of a case to do things.
We got 5 minutes. I think our law enforcement, I know at least in Georgia, I love them because They really, the ones I have talked to, have a heart for it. It grieves them as much as, you know, it grieves us. And but there are just so many of them. And the problem is so huge. And, I mean, on this particular task force, it was for child exploitation. I think there were only four of them. And they had to cover the state of Georgia. So, you know, and that was a grant. That little group was had received a grant, and the grant ran out. I think they got and it hurts them. Yeah, I've met some of the neatest. I used to not care that much for law enforcement, but I have really met some neat, neat guys that really want to stop, and they really care. I mean, we've got police that tell our organization, look, you know, we got a girl getting out tonight. You know, if you want to kind of be hanging out, you know, when she comes out so her pimp can't get her. I mean, they help us. GBI helps us. They'll call. Yeah, yeah. Well, we do. We have a, one of the other things that we're not supposed to talk about is we do have a, like an internet thing that we do some research. And if we find something legit, the other thing that GBI told us is that we get thousands and thousands of reports, and we have to investigate every single one of them. And a lot of them are just bogus little things that people call and say, we think this. But they have to investigate it if it's called in. So they waste a lot of man hours tracking down things that aren't really real. So, yes.
So, yeah, I'm a pastor. And one of the things that I see as a challenge is women in the church actually helping with a woman who's come from that being rescued off the street, rescued out of abusive situations, and actually taking the time to invest in care. So how would I, as a pastor, help women to understand? It's not to feel insecure about it or threatened by it or that somehow you're going to lose if you get invested in this person's life. And that's a challenge.
You're talking about the women in your church that are wanting to reach out to them.
Well, they're not that they're wanting to reach out to them.
Trying to get them to
want. Oh, you want them to reach out. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Well, I think, I don't know if any of you have ever read the book Half the Sky. Half the Sky.
Half the Sky.
One half the sky. It was written by a guy with New York Times who had just a struggle for the issue of just women in general across the world, especially in third world countries. And so he kind of wrote this book and did a documentary on that whole issue. Well, there's another lady, and I can't think of her name. She's written several really good books, and she wrote Half the Church, meaning that half the church is women that God has gifted. And I think women are uniquely gifted to work in this ministry. I think helping them understand how God has created them and how they can reach these women who are so exploited with their gifts. I mean, most of us, my husband might disagree occasionally, but most of us are tenderhearted and, you know, have mothers in us and really want to care and nurture. And I think helping them, having someone come and talk to them about the issue and how God uses women to reach women and to reach children is one way. But then on the flip side of that, those women are going to definitely need a lot of care that are taking care of the women. Because it will drain you dry. It's the most frustrating. You know, you just, you know, the women will come and they'll be off for 3 days and then they'll go back out again. And then they'll call you back weeping and sorry and they want to come back. So it's, and I don't have time to go into all the psychological issues that are going on with these women, but it just takes a long time and you got to be willing to be hurt and know that you're not going to be appreciated. But know that that's what God's called you to. You got to have a little bit of a thick skin. And to not take things personally, but to understand it's, they don't know any, they don't know tenderness and gentleness, so. But I'm free to come and speak at your church if you invite me. So, And I do have a little pad if you want to sign up and get in touch with me. And I also have some business cards if you want to take those and connect with me. And make sure if you didn't get one of these resource sheets that you get one. It's got the information for Polaris and Exodus Cry. And this one is one, I'm taking a course actually on trafficking and how to reach out to these women. And this is in my first course, this is one of the resources, and it's the 11 myths about prostitution. And it's kind of what we think about prostitution, and this kind of destroys some of those. So feel free to get some. And if we run out, I'll get you, if you'll let me know, I'll get you one. But thank you all. You were great and fun. Thanks for bearing with me. It's a tough subject to talk about. So thank y'all for giving me the freedom. So
stop the
recording. That's why I say something I shouldn't.